Thank you so much for joining Dental Marketing Theory, a podcast by Gary Bird. In today's episode, Gary talks with Brian Kalau. Gary and Brian discuss his journey into the world of DSOs and how Dykema works with growing group practices to help them achieve their goals. As always, please make sure to like, subscribe, share, and leave a comment, as all of those things really help to get the word out about Dental Marketing Theory. Hope you enjoy today's show.
All right, we are live, and I'm really excited about my guest today. And before we jump into the good stuff, I want you to go and subscribe to the podcast. It doesn't cost you anything. It takes less than 2 seconds. I know you're ignoring me, and I know you're not doing it right now, but you're going to, if you could just go do that, click the button, subscribe, whether it's on a podcast or YouTube or wherever you're listening at, just subscribe to it. It really, really helps us, and we'll keep making content for you that will help you and your dental practices keep growing. So today I have Brian, and Brian, I want to talk to you about the current state of the world. So there's a lot of different things that are hitting just everything in our lives. It's hitting Main Street all the way to Wall Street. And so it's really impacting dentistry, and you got inflation happening. You got a recession that's about to be announced on July 1st. You have all these big tech companies are doing layoffs. You also have supply chain issues where all of a sudden you can't buy certain things that you used to be able to buy. And then on top of that, you also have just the market is doing crazy things. It's on fire. And so I would love to get your take on how that's impacting dental and what you've been experiencing on your end of things.
Yeah, that's a really good question, Gary. You know, and everybody knows, even if you're not an expert on dental, you know there's a war going on in Ukraine. Yeah. You know we're still dealing with supply chain shortages from COVID. You know inflation is at, you know, I think the highest it's been since 1994 or something like that. The price of borrowing money is going up. You know, the 30-year mortgage interest rates were, like, as of the time of this recording, 5.78%. And we haven't seen that in 25 or 30 years. So what does this have to do with our industry? You know, with dentistry, well, what you're seeing is the lending environment is getting very, very tricky now. It's getting harder to get loans approved. When you do get loans approved, the price of money has gone up. So the interest rates are, you know, significantly higher than they were even 3 months ago. So you can buy less, you know, you can buy smaller practices or less practices, you know, if you're out there trying to do M&A. At the same time, you know, we're still recoiling, Gary, from the great resignation. The cost of labor has gone up quite significantly in dental practices. So that means that our overhead has gone up. So your, you know, EBITDA or profitability is lower in the practices. So, you know, and the price of money has gone up. So, you know, the practices are less valuable, unfortunately, than they were 3 months ago. Now, dentistry has recession-proof, pandemic-proof. It's an incredible industry. So when I say they're less valuable, yes, that's technically true, but that's not to say that we're still not rocking and rolling, relatively speaking, here, because dentistry is such an incredibly robust industry. It survived tons and tons of downturns, like the 2000.com crisis, the subprime mortgage crisis in 2006. It easily, you know, came out of COVID stronger than before. So, you know, we're still doing well. But relatively speaking to where we were even 3, 4, 5 months ago, the practices are less valuable for all these reasons.
Yeah, those are great points. And you know what? I'm glad you brought up the dot-com boom, because the dot-com era, I remember it, but I wasn't in dental at the time. So what happened during that time, and how did the market adjust? Because basically you had a bunch of people with overinflated businesses that weren't really worth anything. They were just worth something on paper, and people were buying. It sounds like almost like the NFT market, right? Where it's just like people are buying and selling things that we don't really know what the actual values are. And then all of a sudden the bottom fell out. How did that impact dental?
Not at all. I mean, you just, you know, at least for purposes of this discussion in 2022, I think did a real good job of, in about 10 seconds, describing the dot-com burst. You know, we had things we didn't know what they were worth, and everybody was overpaying for them, thinking this new dot-com internet thing was going to just, and you know, it obviously was amazing for, you know, society and the human race, but it didn't really play out in a lot of the valuations of a lot of these Johnny-come-lately everybody wanted to be a .com, and it really didn't turn out for a lot of companies. Like, for example, if you were Amazon back in 2000, you did incredibly well. If you were Apple, you know, you did incredibly well. But if you were, you know, I can't even think of one right now. There were so many.
Yeah, there was a lot of them.
You kind of went out of business, and it ended like disastrously. One day your stock price was like, I don't know, $75. The next day it wasn't 60 or 50. It was like zero. You were like out of business.
Yep.
And you know, that's what happened. But how did that affect dentistry? Not at all. People went to the dentist.
So,
and they continued to go to the dentist. And when the subprime mortgage crisis happened in 2006 and people were losing their homes and you couldn't get money, it was a crisis.
Yeah.
People still went to the dentist. So,
okay, so
you know,
from the
dentistry is very resilient.
So from the patient standpoint, the general dentistry didn't really change. I know specialty took a hit in a haircut during some of those periods, but the general dentistry didn't really fluctuate that much. But how did it impact the, and we probably don't know this because the industry wasn't consolidating at that time the way that it is now. So let's forecast that. How is this going to impact the dental market? Does this mean the bigger companies are going to grow even faster because they're the ones to access the capital? Or does it mean the smaller guy has more time now because it's going to slow down the speed of the consolidation? What's your thoughts?
Well, what you're going to likely see is less competition for certain assets. Remember, competition drives up the price in and of itself.
Mm.
Even if, you know, something's worth $1 and everybody agrees it's worth $1, but 10 people are bidding on it, you know, it always ends up going up. There's two, you know, primary criteria for valuations. One, you know, a nuts and bolts, what is the thing worth based on established principles in the industry? And then the second one is what two people in an arm's length transaction will pay for it. And, you know, competition usually drives things up. So there's going to be less competition. Some people are in a very strong financial position. When I say some people, some buyers, to be more precise, some private equity groups, some strategic DSOs, they've got really good credit facilities in place. Or, you know, they've got the cash to spend and they're probably going to be okay. But a lot of buyers in the last 2 years, 3 years were heavily reliant on credit facilities. And if the price to borrow money has gone up, they're going to be able to buy less, bid less, and not bid as much for assets. So it could end up, if there's less competition, with the prices being a little less for some of the assets out there. You know, I'm hearing conflicting things. You know, I'm hearing from banks right now. I'm hearing from some buyers that, you know, things that were approved in the first quarter of this year that are now closing now, they're going ahead and closing. They were approved already. It's happening. But they're saying, hey, don't bring those deals to us in the third and fourth quarter because we're not gonna be able to do the same thing. I'm hearing, though, Gary, on the smaller end, onesies and twosies practices, smaller deals, you know, maybe $10 million or less, are seeing little impact. The valuations are the same now as they were 6 months ago. But on the bigger side, you know, you've got something with $5 or $6 million in EBITDA, and that could have been worth $50 or $60 million easily, you know, first quarter of this year. You might see that asset, you know, go down 36, 40 million, you know, somebody, and what I'm doing is I'm saying somebody might pay a 6 or a 7 or an 8 multiple instead of a 10 or 11 or 12 multiple now.
So if I'm a DSO, if I have a practice like that, then now's probably not the time to sell, right? So I'm probably going to.
It may not be. And you know, it comes down though to a case by case determination. You know, before COVID, we almost, Gary, had like a Kelly Blue Book. If you had 3 million of EBITDA, go look at the Blue Book. This is what you're going to get. Once COVID hit, it became a case by case determination. Mm. If your organization is the class, you know, best in class for who you are, if you recovered completely by COVID, if you're not being affected at all by the current market conditions, you know, you may still get a premium. You may get top value. Another organization that 6 months ago easily would have been sold might be worth a lot less now. So I certainly wouldn't say, you know, on this show that it's guaranteed that you shouldn't sell now or you shouldn't do it. I'm encouraging people to test the market, go do it. But what I'm saying is don't, you know, be overly disappointed in this environment or be too down on yourself if you test the market and your particular organization isn't worth what you thought it was worth or what it would have been worth a few months ago. In that instance, Gary, you may want to wait. You may want to wait a year or two or something. But there will be a lot of deals that will get done notwithstanding the current market conditions because it's a case-by-case determination. Dentistry is incredibly resilient, and those organizations that are best in class or in demand at a given time are still going to do pretty well, but it's not going to be this uniform thing where we absolutely guarantee if you
But that's what people are used to. People are used to the uniformity.
No, they're used to it. They were absolutely used to it. If you had $3 million in EBITDA or $4 million in EBITDA, we absolutely guarantee here's a range of what you're going to get. You're going to sell it pretty quick, and that's going to be that. That's not the case anymore. It's going to depend on a case-by-case determination.
You know, it's interesting because it makes me think about like the housing market. So when COVID hit, I thought, oh, all the house prices are going to fall apart. And they did the exact opposite. They all went up. And then it was like, okay, now the housing market's going to go down because there's like the recession coming and things like that. But then some people are arguing no, because not a lot of people are putting their houses on the market because they can't afford houses. So you're actually going to have a supply and demand issue, and that's going to cause the house prices to go up more, even with interest rates going up more. So there's like half believe that it's going to crash, half the other side. So it's like, we don't, to your point, we just don't know. And what are your thoughts on like the recession side of it coming up with? I mean, I'm a believer of if you say recession enough times, I know what the technical term of 2 quarters of negative GDP growth is, a technical recession. But if you just keep saying the R word over and over and over and over again, people start to hold their money, and that has an impact on the economy. What are your thoughts on how that's going to play into what we're seeing?
Well, dentistry has historically been recession-proof or virtually recession-proof. So if the last 100 years are any indicator, it's not going to affect the core business. Remember, we get sidetracked, as right we should, often on like things that are on the periphery of the core business, like M&A, like DSOs and stuff. But the core business is dentistry. Yeah. Are patients going to come, and are, you know, people going to be able to charge them, you know, fees for services and get paid for those dental services? And I think overwhelmingly the answer is yes. I think the core business of dentistry is going to be affected negligibly by if a recession hits here for a couple quarters. What might get affected is the explosive M&A market might taper down just a little bit. It's not going to shut down. There's going to be plenty of deals going on, but this has been insanity. I mean, I've had lawyers literally, I kid you not, reduced almost to tears in the fourth quarter of last year due to being overworked all night and just literally like, you know, I didn't sign up for this, Brian. I can't take this anymore. I can't do 25 deals in a row. They might get what they wish for, you know, instead of 25 deals in a row, it might be, all right, guys, we're only working on 13 or 14 deals, you know, you're going to get a break here. You know, it's been so incredibly explosive, Gary, that even if it slows down a little, it'll still be a nice explosive marketplace.
it's just not super explosive. So I know coming up, I'm actually preparing for your guys' event next month. Tell us a little bit about your event, kind of explain it in a way for those that maybe have never come before, and share a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, it's the event of the industry. If you're a group practice or a DSO or you know, even a solo that may want to do something in the market, wants to understand, you know, your place, I want everybody to hold it to me. I know they expect me to come here and say, hey, it's the best event, but it really is.
Yeah.
We don't make any money on this event. We put every penny we earn. And in this case, I don't know what the final tally is. Last check, we had about $1.6 million. We spent it all on the event. So, you know, for example, what does that mean? That means you're going to get Lindsey Vonn, the Olympic Hall of Fame skier, is going to come speak. If you're a Big Ten fan, you're going to get Tom Izzo, the Michigan State basketball coach, is going to come speak. If you just like cool stuff, you're going to sit and watch a laser light drone show in the evening. If you like 80s music, the Spasmatics, the best 80s band in America, are going to play. Go Google them or look them up on YouTube. And then there's just great content. All of the best of the DSO industry will be at this event. We always say, Gary, you've been there. We want to do best content, best networking, most fun. And that's what we're trying to do this year. We're expecting 1,500 people. It's going to be a complete sellout. If you want to sign up, it's not quite sold out yet. So anybody listening to this can still get in. You go to dykemadso.com and sign up. But, you know, it's about three weeks or so away. I'm predicting, you know, in the next couple weeks, we're going to have to declare a sellout at 1,500 people.
Perfect. Yeah. And then I can't get a hotel. So I signed up too late and I can't get a hotel there. So can you give me a homie hookup on a hotel?
Yeah, you can. You got to go to the Westin. The Gaylord is sold out.
Okay.
We have made arrangements at the Westin at DFW Airport. It's a very nice hotel. It's only 8 minutes away by
car. That's where I'm at. Yeah, it's really
nice. We're putting you like 3 hours away, but no. And I'm, you know, listen, Gary, I'm real sorry about that.
No, it's not your, it's on me. Like I waited till the last minute, like a knucklehead. And so I got the ticket, but I didn't get the hotel because I was like, well, I don't know what days I'm going to stay yet. So it was 100% on me, but
yeah,
the facilities
and they gave us almost 800 rooms and we're still, I mean, I think next year we're, I think the Gaylord has something like around 1200 rooms. And I think we could almost sell, I mean, we could almost take every room in the hotel.
I called him and I was like, hey, just give me a room. I said, I'll take a suite or I'll try this. I tried everything. They're like, no. And then I went to the Westin. They actually have some availability left. So make sure you, the reason I'm bringing that up is make sure that you call and get booked. Cause if you don't, there won't be anywhere for you to stay. So, describe to me a little bit about how you got into dental. Cause you didn't like start off in dental. You start off like you kind of morphed over to dental, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, nobody goes to law school to be the dental guy. That's why
same,
I'm laughing.
Same for marketing.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Nobody does such a thing. If you were to ask me, you know, what I would be doing when I was in law school, like write on a piece of paper, 10 things you might be doing, like the dental lawyer would not have been anything on there. But, you know, the industry was in its infancy in the 90s when I came out of law school, and there were DSOs that were forming the first generation. They had a lot of regulatory problems, a lot of litigation. I got hired by a lot of orthodontists to help them, like 90, 100 orthodontists. It ended up ultimately being, I think it started with 10 or 20 and it grew to almost 100 or more than 100. And I helped them navigate the regulatory issues of the very first DSO. The very first DSO didn't work out so well. It went into bankruptcy.
Really?
There were lots of lawsuits. They had contracts declared illegal. And I was a part of all that at the very, very beginning. And when that all got done, my phone started to ring off the hook because people said there isn't many people that understand these regulations. You seem to because you've been litigating this for the last several years. Can you help us?
Wow.
And I did. You know, I started to take phone calls. This is in the 90s, you know, like as this was wrapping up. And I started to take phone calls. And, you know, here we are. I mean, I think at the turn of the century, so to speak, in the early 2000s, I probably had 25, 30 dental clients and thought that was pretty good. And here we are in the year, I guess, 2022, and I've got over 600 dental clients in all 50 states and 6 Canadian provinces. So the thing has just exponentially grown from those days in the 90s to where it is today.
That's awesome. That's a great testament. And it's interesting because the dental market for the younger people listening used to be protected by legislation. Like you couldn't just go in and open up a dental office because people would stop you. And it sounds like they kind of did the same thing for the first DSO. They tried to stop it. Is that what happened?
Well, they didn't follow the rules, okay? You've got to do a couple things in this industry. You got to get along with your affiliated doctors, you know, because you can't really own them, you know, so to speak. You've got to, your relationship is contractual in nature in most cases with the affiliated doctors that own the dental practices that are affiliated with the DSO. So you got to get along with them. And then you got to follow the regulations. You know, you can't have like absolute contractual control over the practices. You can't interfere with the independent professional judgment of the dentist owners or, you know, for example, or you can't exhibit so much control over the dental office by contract that it interferes with clinical operations. So there's nuances, and this is how I've spent my whole career to date, you know, putting together regulatory compliant contracts between DSOs and dental practices. But if you don't follow those rules, really bad things can happen from the regulators. And unfortunately, the very first DSO didn't get along with with its doctors and didn't follow the rules. So it predictably, you know, ended in, you know, litigation and, you know, negative court filings and a bankruptcy. But today, you know, we've learned how to do all those things. And it's very rare today to find a DSO that, you know, is just not complying flagrantly. I mean, sure, anybody can make a minor mistake, but in terms of just flagrant non-compliance, it's relatively rare to see that today. But that's in part from my experience very, very early on that established the rules and the law in this area.
Yeah. You got to, the rules had to be established because it was kind of uncharted territory and people then had to set the precedent there. So you right now, what, where's like the best place to focus? If you were going to start a DSO, like where, what state would you go to from a legal standpoint? Like where's the best place to practice, would you say?
Well, there are tremendous opportunities. I mean, honestly, the whole country, because remember, Gary, 60% of the people don't go to the dentist. So the whole known universe that we're talking about is about 40%. Yeah. So there's 60% runway to expand. So, you know, there's not any place that I'm like, oh, this is just horrible. You can't do anything here. No, you can expand anywhere. But some particularly hot areas to me are Spanish-speaking areas, really, really hot. There's just a lot of, as diversity has grown in America, you know, there's an absolute demand for Spanish-speaking dental practices. You know, this can be anywhere, but places like Arizona, places like California, places like Texas, you know, are just really doing terrific, you know, in Spanish-speaking communities. That's one. Another one is sort of the Midwest. If you follow the old Big Ten, you know, not this new, like, you know, Penn State and Rutgers thing and Maryland. No, if you go to the old Big Ten and you go to Iowa, and you go to Minnesota, and, you know, Nebraska is over there too. And you look at, you know, those type of rural Illinois, you know, not Chicago, but rural Illinois, you know, there's tremendous opportunities right now in these places for expansion, you know, but it's good everywhere. You know, it's not just what I'm mentioning, but I am seeing particular opportunities in those places.
Perfect. And then where do you see right now, like where are people, you said most of the DSOs are doing what they're trying to do the right thing. They're trying to go in the right direction. But where do you see people stepping in the wrong way or making those mistakes? And it's just happening over and over and over again where you notice a pattern?
Well, the only pattern I can say that I do see, you know, sometimes emerge is dentistry is such a hot industry right now, and so many first-time investors want to get into dentistry. So if there was a pattern, I would say it's with some first-time investors. There are some first-time investors that take the time, hire regulatory counsel, follow the rules. They say, hey, this is our first investment in dentistry. We don't want to screw it up. We're going to do everything right. And kudos to them because there are plenty of them. But if I was to find a trend, it is with certain first-time investors that don't take the time to understand dentistry. You know, they don't understand that you can't directly own the business if you're a non-dentist. You can't dictate clinical things or interfere with clinical
stuff. Do this many. I need you to do 20 crowns a day. What are you doing?
Yeah. I mean, we had some of those troubles and they resulted in criminal prosecutions, you know, 20 years ago. Like, you know, it's not maybe that obvious. That would certainly be a problem, the one you just described. But that's a little rare. Like, you know, you got to do this amount of crowns. I mean, that's just so outrageous. Like, most people sort of get that. But it's a lot more subtle things. You know, we're going to set office hours. We're going to set prices. We're going to dictate what labs you use. We're going to dictate, you know, where you have to buy things from. You know, we're going to, you know, other sort of things. You know, we're going to tell you the exact type of insurance you have to have. I mean, things that can maybe one of those by themselves might be okay. But when you daisy chain them all together, it starts to become a problem. And usually that's it's okay if you do it and then somebody complains and you fix it, but there have been a trend of some first-time investors that they just feel like, hey, we can do whatever we want. We own the business. Yeah. And that's – if there is a trend of non-compliance, that's usually where it comes from. Most of the players that have been in this industry for a long time, you don't see things like that. You occasionally might see a misstep here or there, but it's not like some type of just blatant issue. But with the – you know, in any population, you know, Gary, there's going to be, if I took 100 people here, there's going to be one or two out of 100 are going to be bad actors. There always is. You're never going to get.
Is it on the like private equity side, or are these individual investments, or is it kind of just rookies coming into the space because it's a hot market?
It's everywhere. Okay. It's within rookies. What I'm saying is I've seen rookie lenders make mistakes. I've seen rookie investors on some PE side make mistakes. I've seen rookie DSO people, you know, make mistakes. I don't see it out of industry veterans, the type of things I'm talking about now. Yep. You might see an occasional misstep, but it's not some like, I can't believe they did that. But out of brand new players, and not all of them, again, a lot of them take the time to get this right, but there is a subset of new investors that I do see making missteps. So if there was any pattern I was going to talk about, it would be a subset of brand new first time investors that some, you know, they don't take the time to learn the rules and they make mistakes.
Where do you see the laws for the DSOs kind of changing and adjusting to? Because obviously over time things have kept morphing and changing and adjusting. Where do you see things heading? And is it more in the favor of DSOs? Is it more in favor of the individuals? Like where if you put, and I know you don't know the future, right? We don't know exactly what's going to happen, but to just, if you were to project out, where do you kind of see things heading?
Yeah, no, I think everything's trending more favorable to DSOs. You know, I think it's pretty stable now. When I started doing this, obviously in the 90s, it was like there were brand new opinions and decisions coming out, and it was a total flux. But by about 2014 or 15, we started to get some stability. There weren't any dental boards that were actively trying to put DSOs out of business anymore. They understood them. And it was, you have to follow the rules. You know, you're going to have to follow the rules, but we're not questioning your existence or your right to exist. And I would say since about 2015 to the present, about 7 years, it's been quite stable and DSOs have gained industry acceptance. And I don't think there's going to be anything dramatic one way or the other with conventional DSOs. The part of the industry that still reminds me of DSOs in 2012, 13, and 14 is, you know, the telehealth platforms. There's a lot of stuff going on with clear aligner programs in the United States. And, you know, the AAO is unhappy with them and filing complaints, many of them unfounded, I should say, but filing a lot of complaints against, you know, clear aligner programs and those that do telehealth platforms. And the law, you know, there are telehealth statutes that have given us some guidance that it's allowed and it should be permitted, but there's a lot of details, or you're filling in, you know, the skin and bones, or the meat on the bones, if you will, about, you know, what is exactly going to be permitted in a telehealth context? When is an in-person visit absolutely mandated? What are the limits of what you're going to be able to diagnose? And the thing that's complicating it, it makes it exciting, but it's complicating it, is technology's going up.
It's going
static.
Faster. It's like, not going to slow down. Yeah.
Yeah. Like at 5 years ago, we might have said, and we might have been correct, hey, within the limits of technology today, you know, you can't take an x-ray remotely, or you know, you can't, I don't know about an x-ray, but you know what I mean, you can't diagnose a certain condition remotely or look at that patient's teeth. But if you look at what's going on with the iPhone and some of these things in the last 7 years, and a lot of the artificial intelligence, it's been incredible that you absolutely can diagnose a bunch of stuff with the iPhone now, looking at somebody's mouth, where 5 years ago, you know, you couldn't. But today, you look at how dramatic these cameras are, and the nuances and details of things that can be caught on these cameras, it's evolving dramatically. And if we have this conversation, you and me, and I hope we do, in a year or two, it might even be different in terms of other things that you can detect, you know, with the iPhone. So that's, you know, that part of the industry.
That's interesting.
What can you do through telehealth is still in a state of flux. Part of it is because rules and regulations are being adopted. But the interesting thing is, even when they adopt one set of rules, the technology seems to evolve to obsolete it.
Yeah, you always
used to say,
this always happens in every industry. Like we see it in cars right now. Cars have the ability to drive themselves, but there's no rules around it. So they're like, no, don't do that yet. And they're trying to figure out, okay, what parts can we allow? What parts that we can't? So I feel like the rules always trail the technology because the technology has the flexibility to move faster.
Yes.
But where is like healthcare as a whole at with all this? Have they solved some of that? Are they a little bit further ahead of dentistry, or is dentistry kind of trailing behind because of the nature of the industry?
Dentistry is clearly trailing behind on the telehealth, and I'll tell you why. Because I'm still hearing silly things. Like, you know, I'll read certain publications at, like, for example, the AAO, American Association of Orthodontists, will publish, and they'll say, you know, it's, you know, inappropriate, you know, to have somebody do aligners because, you know, they'll say, you know, only an in-person visit can get it down to 100% degree of precision. And then I read the literature and I'm like, well, yeah, but the telehealth does it to like 99 point something. And the reason it's such a good question, Gary, is regular medicine has been triaging this for years. If you have diabetes, for example, Gary, and there's a $1,000 pill and a $100 pill, your insurance company has already told you for about the last 20 years, you know, Gary, we're going to go with the $100 pill. Even though you might tell me that the $1,000 pill has less side effects and is like absolutely perfect, our doctors and studies are telling us the $100 pill does good enough. It may not be quite as good, but it's good enough, and that's all your insurance is going to pay for. And that's been going on for decades.
Yeah.
So if somebody says, hey, you're going to do sort of a clear aligner program without seeing a dentist, and it's going to be really good, but maybe just not quite to the precise, you know, like to the millimeter, precision of if somebody's like standing in an office, that's been going on for years in healthcare. Mm. And why would you deprive a consumer who quite frankly doesn't care and can't notice in many cases the difference between, you know, something that only like, you know, somebody that's a trained expert under a microscope or something can notice. You can't notice it to the naked eye. You're very happy with the results of your orthodontics. You got it at a lower price point. You know, you got it with greater access. It was more convenient for you. Why are we going to rob the patients of that choice and say, no, it's got to be one way. It's got to be three times the price. And it's got to be, you got to find an orthodontist and go in that office. Even if you live in remote Alaska, Hawaii, Death Valley, California.
It's better. It's almost like you're saying it's better that you don't have care than have a mobile care, right? It's obviously clear that it's better that they have mobile care or telehealth care or some kind of care. That's better than no care, right?
Well, yeah, and it's good. And here's the thing. It's good, okay? It's not bad. I mean, this idea like, well, it's better than nothing. No, it's actually really good. And in a lot of cases, the telehealth stuff is just as good as anything that happens in an office setting. There will be some instances where it's marginally better, maybe if you go to the office. But why would you take that choice out of the consumer's hands? You know, Gary, I've been to Indian reservations. With this great career I've had in dentistry, I've been to Indian reservations. I've been to remote islands in Hawaii where the dental board meeting has to occur on Zoom before Zoom. Like now, everybody knows about Zoom, but even before Zoom, you had to do it on Zoom because you know there's a big ocean between you and the other part of the state. Or I've been in Alaska where a glacier separates one part of Alaska from the other, and you're not going to helicopter the dental board in, so you got to do it on Zoom. And people live there, okay? And mail does go there. It goes by boat, it goes by helicopter. You know, we can afford to ship clear aligners by helicopter. We can't afford to take people every day by helicopters, but the mail delivery happens by helicopter, and we'll helicopter in clear aligners, and these folks can get like really top-notch orthodontic treatment that, again, in many cases is just as good. In some minor things, maybe it's just, you know, negligibly not quite where you might be, but the people want to do it. They want that treatment. They want the lower price point. Why would you take that out of their hands? I mean, I just don't know why you would do that.
Yeah, that's a great point. I love that take. What if people want to reach out to you and kind of learn more about how you could help their DSO or their group, what's the best way to connect with you?
Yeah, I mean, go to Dykema, D-S-O, D-Y-K-E-M-A, D-S-O.com. All my contact information is on there. You can email me or call me. I love meeting people, you know, even if you're like, well, I don't know if I'm going to hire a lawyer, but I'm just curious. I love meeting people. I love answering questions. You come to our event, Dykema, you come up to me, ask me questions. I speak 50, 60 times a year. I just like meeting people. So if you ever want to talk about these things more, I love having these conversations.
Awesome. Is there anything that we didn't cover that you feel like the audience should know about, either with something that you do or the profession as a whole?
No, I mean, I think we had a great discussion. I think everybody should bear in mind, you know, we're in the midst of the great consolidation. That means practices at an unprecedented rate are converting from solo and group dentist-owned to DSO-affiliated models. That's going to continue for the next 10 years. The market consolidation is somewhere around the high 37, 38%. It's going to be over 80 in 10 years. And, you know, you got time to make your decisions, whatever's right for you. You don't necessarily have to rush, but this is what is happening. You need to understand it and you need to come up with a plan. You know, if you're 70 years old, maybe you don't need to. You can retire and it's fine. But if you're in your 30s, 40s, 50s, you know, listening to this, you got even early 60s, you got to come up with a plan for how you're going to position yourself in this marketplace.
100%. You owe it to yourself to know the rules of the game, at least, yeah. Right? Don't go into the game and don't know how to play it. And I think that's what you guys really provide a lot of context around, is letting people know where their guide rails are and where to stay and stay safe. So thank you so much for all you do for an industry. I always learn a lot from listening to you, and I appreciate you covering all these topics today with us.
Gary, always a pleasure to see you. Looking forward to seeing you at our conference in a couple weeks, and thanks for having me here.
Yes, sir. I'll see you in a couple weeks.
All right.
Thanks so much for watching today. If you'd like to learn more about SMC or the guests that you listen to, please visit us at smcnational.com.